The typical strongman either deprives courts of their powers or packs them with his loyalists and seeks to close all independent media outlets while building his own omnipresent propaganda machine. Once the courts are no longer able to check the government's power by legal means, and once the media obediently parrots the government line, all other institutions or persons who dare oppose the government can be smeared and persecuted as traitors, criminals, or foreign agents. Academic institutions, municipalities, NGOs, and private businesses are either dismantled or brought under government control. At that stage, the government can also rig the elections at will, for example, by jailing popular opposition leaders, preventing opposition parties from participating in the elections, gerrymandering election districts, or disenfranchising voters. Appeals against these anti-democratic measures are dismissed by the government's hand-picked judges. Journalists and academics who criticize these measures are fired. The remaining media outlets, academic institutions, and judicial authorities all praise these measures as necessary steps to protect the nation and its allegedly democratic system from traitors and foreign agents. The strongmen don't usually take the final step of abolishing the elections outright. Instead, they keep them as a ritual that serves to provide legitimacy and maintain the democratic facade, as happens, for example, in Putin's Russia. Supporters of strongmen often don't see this process as anti-democratic. They are genuinely baffled when told that electoral victory doesn't grant them unlimited power. Instead, they see any check on the power of an elected government as undemocratic. However, democracy doesn't mean majority rule. Rather, it means freedom and equality for all. Democracy is a system that guarantees everyone certain liberties which even the majority cannot take away. Nobody disputes that in a democracy, the representatives of the majority are entitled to form the government and to advance their preferred policies in myriad fields. If the majority wants war, the country goes to war. If the majority wants peace, the country makes peace. If the majority wants to raise taxes, taxes are raised. If the majority wants to lower taxes, taxes are lowered. Major decisions about foreign affairs, defense, education, taxation, and numerous other policies are all in the hands of the majority. But in a democracy, there are two baskets of rights that are protected from the majority's grasp. One contains human rights. Even if 99% of the population wants to exterminate the remaining 1%, in a democracy this is forbidden, because it violates the most basic human right, the right to life. The basket of human rights contains many additional rights, such as the right to work, the right to privacy, freedom of movement, and freedom of religion. These rights enshrine the decentralized nature of democracy, making sure that as long as people don't harm anyone, they can live their lives as they see fit. The second crucial basket of rights contains civil rights. These are the basic rules of the democratic game, which enshrine its self-correcting mechanisms. An obvious example is the right to vote. If the majority were permitted to disenfranchise the minority, then democracy would be over after a single election. Other civil rights include freedom of the press, academic freedom, and freedom of assembly, which enable independent media outlets, universities, and opposition movements to challenge the government. These are the key rights that strongmen seek to violate. While sometimes it is necessary to make changes to a country's self-correcting mechanisms, for example, by expanding the franchise, regulating the media, or reforming the judicial system, such changes should be made only on the basis of a broad consensus, including both majority and minority groups. If a small majority could unilaterally change civil rights, it could easily rig elections and get rid of all other checks on its power. An important thing to note about both human rights and civil rights is that they don't just limit the power of the central government, they also impose on it many active duties. It is not enough for a democratic government to abstain from infringing on human and civil rights. It must take actions to ensure them. For example, the right to life imposes on a democratic government the duty to protect citizens from criminal violence. If a government doesn't kill anyone, but also makes no effort to protect citizens from murder, this is anarchy rather than democracy. The people versus the truth. Of course, in every democracy, there are lengthy discussions concerning the exact limits of human and civil rights. Even the right to life has limits. There are democratic countries like the United States that impose the death penalty, thereby denying some criminals the right to life. And every country allows itself the prerogative to declare war, thereby sending people to kill and be killed. So where exactly does the right to life end? There are also complicated and ongoing discussions concerning the list of rights that should be included in the two baskets. Who determined that freedom of religion is a basic human right? Should internet access be defined as a civil right? And what about animal rights? Or the rights of AI? We cannot resolve these matters here. Both human and civil rights are intersubjective conventions that humans invent rather than discover, and they are determined by historical contingencies rather than universal reason. Different democracies can adopt somewhat different lists of rights. At least from the viewpoint of information flows, what defines a system as democratic is only that its center doesn't have unlimited authority and that the system possesses robust mechanisms to correct the center's mistakes. Democratic networks assume that everyone is fallible, and that includes even the winners of elections and the majority of voters. It is particularly crucial to remember that elections are not a method for discovering truth. Rather, they are a method for maintaining order by adjudicating between people's conflicting desires. Elections establish what the majority of people desire rather than what the truth is. And people often desire the truth to be other than what it is. Democratic networks therefore maintain some self-correcting mechanisms to protect the truth even from the will of the majority. For example, during the 2002-03 debate over whether to invade Iraq in the wake of the September 11 attacks, the Bush administration claimed that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction and that the Iraqi people were eager to establish an American-style democracy and would welcome the Americans as liberators. These arguments carried the day. In October 2002, the elected representatives of the American people in Congress voted overwhelmingly to authorize the invasion. The resolution passed with a 296 to 133 majority, 69% in the House of Representatives, and a 77 to 23 majority, 77% in the Senate. In the early days of the war in March 2003, polls found that the elected representatives were indeed in tune with the mass of voters and that 72% of American citizens supported the invasion. The will of the American people was clear. But the truth turned out to be different from what the government said and what the majority believed. As the war progressed, it became evident that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction and that many Iraqis had no wish to be liberated by the Americans or to establish a democracy. By August 2004, another poll found that 67% of Americans believed that the invasion was based on incorrect assumptions. As the years went by, most Americans acknowledged that the decision to invade was a catastrophic mistake. In a democracy, the majority has every right to make momentous decisions like starting wars, and that includes the right to make momentous errors. But the majority should at least acknowledge its own fallibility and protect the freedom of minorities to hold and publicize unpopular views, which might turn out to be correct. As another example, consider the case of a charismatic leader who is accused of corruption. His loyal supporters obviously wish these accusations to be false. But even if most voters support the leader, Their desires should not prevent judges from investigating the accusations and getting to the truth. As with the justice system, so also with science. A majority of voters might deny the reality of climate change, but they should not have the power to dictate scientific truth or to prevent scientists from exploring and publishing inconvenient facts. Unlike parliaments, departments of environmental studies should not reflect the will of the majority. Of course, when it comes to making policy decisions about climate change, in a democracy, the will of the voters should reign supreme. Acknowledging the reality of climate change does not tell us what to do about it. We always have options, and choosing between them is a question of desire, not truth. One option might be to immediately cut greenhouse gas emissions, even at the cost of slowing economic growth. This means incurring some difficulties today, but saving people in 2050 from more severe hardship, saving the island nation of Kiribati from drowning, and saving the polar bears from extinction. A second option might be to continue with business as usual. This means having an easier life today, but making life harder for the next generation, flooding Kiribati, and driving the polar bears, as well as numerous other species, to extinction. Choosing between these two options is a question of desire, and should therefore be done by all voters rather than by a limited group of experts. But the one option that should not be on offer in elections is hiding or distorting the truth. If the majority prefers to consume whatever amount of fossil fuels it wishes with no regard to future generations or other environmental considerations, it is entitled to vote for that. But the majority should not be entitled to pass a law stating that climate change is a hoax and that all professors who believe in climate change must be fired from their academic posts. We can choose what we want, but we shouldn't deny the true meaning of our choice. Naturally, academic institutions, the media, and the judiciary may themselves be compromised by corruption, bias, or error. But subordinating them to a governmental ministry of truth is likely to make things worse. The government is already the most powerful institution in developed societies, and it often has the greatest interest in distorting or hiding inconvenient facts. Allowing the government to supervise the search for truth is like appointing the fox to guard the chicken coop. To discover the truth, it is better to rely on two other methods. First, academic institutions, the media, and the judiciary have their own internal self-correcting mechanisms for fighting corruption, correcting bias, and exposing error. In academia, peer-reviewed publication is a far better check on error than supervision by government officials, because academic promotion often depends on uncovering past mistakes and discovering unknown facts. In the media, free competition means that if one outlet decides not to break a scandal, perhaps for self-serving reasons, others are likely to jump at the scoop. In the judiciary, a judge who takes bribes may be tried and punished just like any other citizen. Second, the existence of several independent institutions that seek the truth in different ways allows these institutions to check and correct one another. For example, if powerful corporations manage to break down the peer review mechanism by bribing a sufficiently large number of scientists, investigative journalists and courts can expose and punish the perpetrators. If the media or the courts are afflicted by systematic racist biases, it is the job of sociologists, historians and philosophers to expose those biases. None of these mechanisms are completely fail-safe, but no human institution is. Government certainly isn't. The populist assault. If all this sounds complicated, it is because democracy should be complicated. Simplicity is a characteristic of dictatorial information networks in which the center dictates everything and everybody silently obeys. It's easy to follow this dictatorial monologue. In contrast, Democracy is a conversation with numerous participants, many of them talking at the same time. It can be hard to follow such a conversation. Moreover, the most important democratic institutions tend to be bureaucratic behemoths. Whereas citizens avidly follow the biographical dramas of the princely court and the presidential palace, they often find it difficult to understand how parliaments, courts, newspapers, and universities function. This is what helps strongmen mount populist attacks on institutions, dismantle all self-correcting mechanisms, and concentrate power in their own hands. We discussed populism briefly in the prologue to help explain the populist challenge to the naive view of information. Here we need to revisit populism, get a broader understanding of its worldview, and explain its appeal to anti-democratic strongmen. The term populism derives from the Latin populus, which means the people. In democracies, the people is considered the sole legitimate source of political authority. Only representatives of the people should have the authority to declare wars, pass laws, and raise taxes. Populists cherish this basic democratic principle, but somehow conclude from it that a single party or a single leader should monopolize all power. In a curious political alchemy, populists manage to base a totalitarian pursuit of unlimited power on a seemingly impeccable democratic principle. How does it happen? The most novel claim populists make is that they alone truly represent the people. Since in democracies only the people should have political power, and since allegedly only the populists represent the people, it follows that the populist party should have all political power to itself. If some party other than the populists wins elections, it does not mean that this rival party won the people's trust and is entitled to form a government. Rather, it means that the elections were stolen or that the people were deceived to vote in a way that doesn't express their true will. It should be stressed that for many populists, this is a genuinely held belief rather than a propaganda gambit. Even if they win just a small share of votes, populists may still believe they alone represent the people. An analogous case are communist parties. In the UK, for example, the Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB, never won more than 0.4% of votes in the general election, but was nevertheless adamant that it alone truly represented the working class. Millions of British workers, they claimed, were voting for the Labour Party or even for the Conservative Party rather than for the CPGB because of false consciousness. Allegedly, through their control of the media, universities, and other institutions, the capitalists managed to deceive the working class into voting against its true interests, and only the CPGB could see through this deception. In like fashion, populists can believe that the enemies of the people have deceived the people to vote against its true will, which the populists alone represent. A fundamental part of this populist credo is the belief that the people is not a collection of flesh and blood individuals with various interests and opinions, but rather a unified mystical body that possesses a single will, the will of the people. Perhaps the most notorious and extreme manifestation of this semi-religious belief was the Nazi motto Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, which means one people, one country, one leader. Nazi ideology posited that the Volk, people, had a single will, whose sole authentic representative was the Führer, leader. The leader allegedly had an infallible intuition for how the people felt and what the people wanted. If some German citizens disagreed with the leader, it didn't mean that the leader might be in the wrong. Rather, it meant that the dissenters belonged to some treasonous outsider group, Jews, communists, liberals, instead of to the people. The Nazi case is, of course, extreme, and it is grossly unfair to accuse all populists of being crypto-Nazis with genocidal inclinations. However, many populist parties and politicians deny that the people might contain a diversity of opinions and interest groups. They insist that the real people has only one will and that they alone represent this will. In contrast, their political rivals, even when the latter enjoys substantial popular support, are depicted as alien elites. Thus, Hugo Chavez ran for the presidency in Venezuela with the slogan, "Chavez is the people." President Erdogan of Turkey once railed against his domestic critics, saying, "We are the people. Who are you?" As if his critics weren't Turks too. How can you tell then whether someone is part of the people or not? Easy. If they support the leader, they are part of the people. This, according to the German political philosopher Jan Werner Müller, is the defining feature of populism. What turns someone into a populist is claiming that they alone represent the people and that anyone who disagrees with them, whether state bureaucrats, minority groups, or even the majority of voters, either suffers from false consciousness or isn't really part of the people. This is why populism poses a deadly threat to democracy. While democracy agrees that the people is the only legitimate source of power, democracy is based on the understanding that the people is never a unitary entity and therefore cannot possess a single will. Every people, whether Germans, Venezuelans, or Turks, is composed of many different groups with a plurality of opinions, wills, and representatives. No group, including the majority group, is entitled to exclude other groups from membership in the people. This is what makes democracy a conversation. Holding a conversation presupposes the existence of several legitimate voices. If, however, the people has only one legitimate voice, there can be no conversation. Rather, the single voice dictates everything. Populism may therefore claim adherence to the democratic principle of people's power, but it effectively empties democracy of meaning and seeks to establish a dictatorship. Populism undermines democracy in another, more subtle, but equally dangerous way. Having claimed that they alone represent the people, populists argue that the people is not just the sole legitimate source of political authority, but the sole legitimate source of all authority. Any institution that derives its authority from something other than the will of the people is anti-democratic. As the self-proclaimed representatives of the people, populists consequently seek to monopolize not just political authority, but all types of authority, and to take control of institutions such as media outlets, courts, and universities. By taking the democratic principle of people's power to its extreme, populists turn totalitarian. In fact, while democracy means that authority in the political sphere comes from the people, it doesn't deny the validity of alternative sources of authority in other spheres. As just discussed, in a democracy, independent media outlets, courts, and universities are essential self-correcting mechanisms that protect the truth even from the will of the majority. Biology professors claim that humans evolved from apes because the evidence supports this, even if the majority wills it to be otherwise. Journalists can reveal that a popular politician took a bribe, and if compelling evidence is presented in court, a judge may send that politician to jail, even if most people don't want to believe these accusations. Populists are suspicious of institutions that, in the name of objective truths, override the supposed will of the people. They tend to see this as a smokescreen for elites grabbing illegitimate power. This drives populists to be skeptical of the pursuit of truth, and to argue, as we saw in the prologue, that power is the only reality. They thereby seek to undercut or appropriate the authority of any independent institutions that might oppose them. The result is a dark and cynical view of the world as a jungle and of human beings as creatures obsessed with power alone. All social interactions are seen as power struggles, and all institutions are depicted as cliques promoting the interests of their own members. In the populist imagination, courts don't really care about justice. They only protect the privileges of the judges. Yes, the judges talk a lot about justice, but this is a ploy to grab power for themselves. Newspapers don't care about facts. They spread fake news to mislead the people and benefit the journalists and the cabals that finance them. Even scientific institutions aren't committed to the truth. Biologists, climatologists, epidemiologists, economists, historians, and mathematicians are just another interest group feathering its own nest at the expense of the people. In all, it's a rather sordid view of humanity. But two things nevertheless make it appealing to many. First, since it reduces all interactions to power struggles, it simplifies reality and makes events like wars, economic crises, and natural disasters easy to understand. Anything that happens, even a pandemic, is about elites pursuing power. Second, the populist view is attractive because it is sometimes correct. Every human institution is indeed fallible and suffers from some level of corruption. Some judges do take bribes. Some journalists do intentionally mislead the public. Academic disciplines are occasionally plagued by bias and nepotism. That is why every institution needs self-correcting mechanisms. But since populists are convinced that power is the only reality, they cannot accept that a court, a media outlet, or an academic discipline would ever be inspired by the value of truth or justice to correct itself. While many people embrace populism because they see it as an honest account of human reality, strongmen are attracted to it for a different reason. Populism offers strongmen an ideological basis for making themselves dictators while pretending to be democrats. It is particularly useful when strongmen seek to neutralize or appropriate the self-correcting mechanisms of democracy. Since judges, journalists, and professors allegedly pursue political interests rather than truth, the people's champion, the strongman, should control these positions instead of allowing them to fall into the hands of the people's enemies. Similarly, since even the officials in charge of arranging elections and publicizing their results may be part of a nefarious conspiracy, they too should be replaced by the strongman's loyalists. In a well-functioning democracy, citizens trust the results of elections, the decisions of courts, the reports of media outlets, and the findings of scientific disciplines, because citizens believe these institutions are committed to the truth. Once people think that power is the only reality, they lose trust in all these institutions, democracy collapses, and the strongmen can seize total power. Of course, populism could lead to anarchy rather than totalitarianism if it undermines trust in the strongmen themselves. If no human is interested in truth or justice, doesn't this apply to Mussolini or Putin too? And if no human institution can have effective self-correcting mechanisms, doesn't this include Mussolini's National Fascist Party or Putin's United Russia Party? How can the deep-seated distrust of all elites and institutions be squared with unwavering admiration for one leader and party? This is why populists ultimately depend on the mystical notion that the strongman embodies the people. When trust in bureaucratic institutions like election boards, courts, and newspapers is particularly low, an enhanced reliance on mythology is the only way to preserve order. Measuring the strength of democracies. Strongmen who claim to represent the people may well rise to power through democratic means and often rule behind a democratic facade. Rigged elections in which they win overwhelming majorities serve as proof of the mystical bond between the leader and the people. Consequently, to measure how democratic an information network is, We cannot use a simple yardstick like whether elections are being held regularly. In Putin's Russia, in Iran, and even in North Korea, elections are held like clockwork. Rather, we need to ask much more complex questions, like what mechanisms prevent the central government from rigging the elections? How safe is it for leading media outlets to criticize the government? And how much authority does the center appropriate to itself?
Democracy and dictatorship aren't binary opposites, but rather are on a continuum.
To decide whether a network is closer to the democratic or the dictatorial end of the continuum, we need to understand how information flows in the network and what shapes the political conversation. If one person dictates all the decisions, and even their closest advisers are terrified to voice a dissenting view, no conversation is taking place. Such a network is situated at the extreme dictatorial end of the spectrum. If nobody can voice unorthodox opinions publicly, but behind closed doors, a small circle of party bosses or senior officials are able to freely express their views, then this is still a dictatorship, but it has taken a baby step in the direction of democracy. If 10% of the population participate in the political conversation by airing their opinions, voting in fair elections, and running for office, that may be considered a limited democracy, as was the case in many ancient city-states like Athens, or in the early days of the United States, when only wealthy white men had such political rights. As the percentage of people taking part in the conversation rises, so the network becomes more democratic. The focus on conversations rather than elections raises a host of interesting questions. For example, where does that conversation take place? North Korea, for example, has the Mansudae Assembly Hall in Pyongyang, where the 687 members of the Supreme People's Assembly meet and talk. However, while this assembly is officially known as North Korea's legislature, and while elections to the assembly are held every 5 years, this body is widely considered a rubber stamp, executing decisions taken elsewhere. The anodyne discussions follow a predetermined script, and they aren't geared to change anyone's mind about anything. Is there perhaps another, more private hall in Pyongyang where the crucial conversations take place? Do Politburo members ever dare criticize Kim Jong-un's policies during formal meetings? Perhaps it can be done in unofficial dinner parties or in unofficial think tanks. Information in North Korea is so concentrated and so tightly controlled that we cannot provide clear answers to these questions. Similar questions can be asked about the United States. In the United States, unlike in North Korea, people are free to say almost anything they want. Scathing public attacks on the government are a daily occurrence. But where is the room where the crucial conversations happen, and who sits there? The US Congress was designed to fulfill this function, with the people's representatives meeting to converse and try to convince one another. But when was the last time that an eloquent speech in Congress by a member of one party persuaded members of the other party to change their minds about anything? Wherever the conversations that shape American politics now take place, it is definitely not in Congress. Democracies die not only when people are not free to talk, but also when people are not willing or able to listen. Stone Age democracies. Based on this definition of democracy, we can now turn to the historical record and examine how changes in information technology and information flows have shaped the history of democracy. To judge by the archaeological and anthropological evidence, democracy was the most typical political system among archaic hunter-gatherers. Stone Age bands obviously didn't have formal institutions like elections, courts, and media outlets, but their information networks were usually distributed and gave ample opportunities for self-correction. In bands numbering just a few dozen people, information could easily be shared among all group members,
And when the band decided where to pitch camp, where to go hunting, or how to handle a conflict with another band, everyone could take part in the conversation and dispute one another. Bands usually belonged to a larger tribe that included hundreds or even thousands of people. But when important choices affecting the whole tribe had to be made, such as whether to go to war, tribes were usually still small enough for a large percentage of their members to gather in one place and converse. While bands and tribes sometimes had dominant leaders, these tended to exercise only limited authority. Leaders had no standing armies, police forces, or governmental bureaucracies at their disposal, so they couldn't just impose their will by force. Leaders also found it difficult to control the economic basis of people's lives. In modern times, dictators like Vladimir Putin and Saddam Hussein have often based their political power on monopolizing economic assets like oil wells. In medieval and classical antiquity, Chinese emperors, Greek tyrants, and Egyptian pharaohs dominated society by controlling granaries, silver mines, and irrigation canals. In contrast, in a hunter-gatherer economy, such centralized economic control was possible only under special circumstances. For example, along the northwestern coast of North America, some hunter-gatherer economies relied on catching and preserving large numbers of salmon. Since salmon runs peaked for a few weeks in specific creeks and rivers, a powerful chief could monopolize this asset. But this was exceptional. Most hunter-gatherer economies were far more diversified. One leader, even supported by a few allies, could not corral the savannah and prevent people from gathering plants and hunting animals there. If all else failed, hunter-gatherers could therefore vote with their feet. They had few possessions, and their most important assets were their personal skills and personal friends. If a chief turned dictatorial, people could just walk away. Even when hunter-gatherers did end up ruled by a domineering chief, as happened among the salmon-fishing people of northwestern America, at least that chief was accessible. He didn't live in a faraway fortress, surrounded by an unfathomable bureaucracy and a cordon of armed guards. If you wanted to voice a complaint or suggestion, you could usually get within earshot of him. The chief couldn't control public opinion, nor could he shut himself off from it. In other words, there was no way for a chief to force all information to flow through the center or to prevent people from talking with one another, criticizing him, or organizing against him. In the millennia following the agricultural revolution, and especially after writing helped create large bureaucratic polities, it became easier to centralize the flow of information and harder to maintain the democratic conversation. In small city-states like those of ancient Mesopotamia and Greece, autocrats like Lugal Zaggisi of Umma and Pisistratus of Athens relied on bureaucrats, archives, and a standing army to monopolize key economic assets and information about ownership, taxation, diplomacy, and politics. It simultaneously became harder for the mass of citizens to keep in direct touch with one another. There was no mass communication technology like newspapers or radio, and it was not easy to squeeze tens of thousands of citizens into the main city square to hold a communal discussion. Democracy was still an option for these small city-states, as the history of both early Sumer and classical Greece clearly indicates. However, the democracy of ancient city-states tended to be less inclusive than the democracy of archaic hunter-gatherer bands. Probably the most famous example of ancient city-state democracy is Athens in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE. All adult male citizens could participate in the Athenian assembly, vote on public policy, and be elected to public offices. But women, slaves, and non-citizen residents of the city did not enjoy these privileges. Only about 25-30% of the adult population of Athens enjoyed full political rights. As the size of polities continued to increase, and city-states were superseded by larger kingdoms and empires, even Athenian-style partial democracy disappeared. All the famous examples of ancient democracies are city-states such as Athens and Rome. In contrast, we don't know of any large-scale kingdom or empire that operated along democratic lines. For example, when in the 5th century BCE, Athens expanded from a city-state into an empire, it did not grant citizenship and political rights to those it conquered. The city of Athens remained a limited democracy, but the much bigger Athenian Empire was ruled autocratically from the center. All the important decisions about taxes, diplomatic alliances, and military expeditions were taken in Athens. Subject lands like the islands of Naxos and Thasos had to obey the orders of the Athenian Popular Assembly and elected officials, without the Naxians and Thasians being able to vote in that assembly or be elected to office. It was also difficult for Naxos, Thasos, and other subject lands to coordinate a united opposition to the decisions taken in the Athenian center, and if they tried to do so, it would have brought ruthless Athenian reprisals. Information in the Athenian Empire flowed to and from Athens. When the Roman Republic built its empire, conquering first the Italian peninsula and eventually the entire Mediterranean basin, the Romans took a somewhat different course. Rome gradually did extend citizenship to the conquered people. It began by granting citizenship to the inhabitants of Latium, then to the inhabitants of other Italian regions, and finally to inhabitants of even distant provinces like Gallia and Syria. However, as citizenship was extended to more people, the political rights of citizens were simultaneously restricted. The ancient Romans had a clear understanding of what democracy means, and they were originally fiercely committed to the democratic ideal. After expelling the last king of Rome in 509 BCE, the Romans developed a deep dislike for monarchy and a fear of giving unlimited power to any single individual or institution. Supreme executive power was therefore shared by two consuls who balanced each other. These consuls were chosen by citizens in free elections, held office for a single year, and were additionally checked by the powers of the Popular Assembly, of the Senate, and of other elected officials like the tribunes. But when Rome extended citizenship to Latins, Italians, and finally to Gauls and Syrians, the power of the Popular Assembly, the tribunes, the Senate, and even the two consuls was gradually reduced, until in the late 1st century BCE, the Caesar family established its autocratic rule. Anticipating present-day strongmen like Putin, Augustus didn't crown himself king and presented that Rome was still a republic. The Senate and the Popular Assembly continued to convene, and every year citizens continued to choose consuls and tribunes. But these institutions were emptied of real power. In 212 CE, the Emperor Caracalla, the offspring of a Phoenician family from North Africa, took a seemingly momentous step and granted automatic Roman citizenship to all free adult males throughout the vast empire. Rome in the 3rd century CE accordingly had tens of millions of citizens. But by that time, all the important decisions were made by a single unelected emperor. While consuls were still ceremonially chosen every year, Caracalla inherited power from his father, Septimius Severus, who became emperor by winning a civil war. The most important step Caracalla took to cement his rule was murdering his brother and rival, Geta. When Caracalla ordered the murder of Geta, declared war on the Parthian Empire, or extended Roman citizenship to millions of Britons, Greeks, and Arabs, he had no need to ask permission from the Roman people. All of Rome's self-correcting mechanisms had been neutralized long before. If Caracalla made some error in foreign or domestic policy, neither the Senate nor any officials could intervene to correct it, except by rising in rebellion or assassinating him. And when Caracalla was indeed assassinated in 217, it only led to a new round of civil wars, culminating in the rise of new autocrats. Rome in the 3rd century CE, like Russia in the 18th century, was, in the words of Madame de Stael, autocracy tempered by strangulation. By the 3rd century CE, not only the Roman Empire but all other major human societies on Earth were centralized information networks lacking strong self-correcting mechanisms. This was true of the Parthian and Sasanian empires in Persia, of the Kushan and Gupta empires in India, and of China's Han Empire and its successor, Three Kingdoms. Thousands of more small-scale societies continued to function democratically in the 3rd century CE and beyond, but it seemed that distributed democratic networks were simply incompatible with large-scale societies. Caesar for president. Were large-scale democracies really unworkable in the ancient world? Or did autocrats like Augustus and Caracalla deliberately sabotage them? This question is important, not only for our understanding of ancient history, but also for our view of democracy's future in the age of AI. How do we know whether democracies fail because they are undermined by strongmen or because of much deeper structural and technological reasons? To answer that question, let's take a closer look at the Roman Empire. The Romans were clearly familiar with the democratic ideal, and it continued to be important to them even after the Caesar family rose to power. Otherwise, Augustus and his heirs would not have bothered to maintain seemingly democratic institutions like the Senate or annual elections to the consulate and other offices. So why did power end up in the hands of an unelected emperor? In theory, even after Roman citizenship was expanded to tens of millions of people throughout the Mediterranean basin, wasn't it possible to hold empire-wide elections for the position of emperor? This would surely have required very complicated logistics, and it would have taken several months to learn the results of the elections. But was that really a deal-breaker? The key misconception here is equating democracy with elections. Tens of millions of Roman citizens could theoretically vote for this or that imperial candidate. But the real question we should ask is whether the Roman Empire could have held an ongoing empire-wide political conversation. In present-day North Korea, no democratic conversation takes place because people aren't free to talk. Yet we could well imagine a situation when this freedom is guaranteed, as it is in South Korea. In the present-day United States, the democratic conversation is endangered by people's inability to listen to and respect their political rivals. Yet this can presumably still be fixed. By contrast, in the Roman Empire, there was simply no way to conduct or sustain a democratic conversation because the technological means to hold such a conversation did not exist. To hold a conversation, it is not enough to have the freedom to talk and the ability to listen. There are also two technical preconditions. First, people need to be within hearing range of one another. This means that the only way to hold a political conversation in a territory the size of the United States or the Roman Empire is with the help of some kind of information technology that can swiftly convey what people say over long distances. Second, people need at least a rudimentary understanding of what they are talking about. Otherwise, they are just making noise, not holding a meaningful conversation. People usually have a good understanding of political issues of which they have direct experience. Poor people have many insights about poverty that escape economics professors, and ethnic minorities understand racism in a much more profound way than people who never suffered from it, for example. However, if lived experience were the only way to understand crucial political issues, large-scale political conversations would be impossible. For then every group of people could talk meaningfully only about its own experiences. Even worse, nobody else could understand what they were saying. If lived experience is the sole possible source of knowledge, then merely listening to the insights gained from someone else's lived experience cannot impart these insights to me. The only way to have a large-scale political conversation among diverse groups of people is if people can gain some understanding of issues that they have never experienced firsthand. In a large polity, it is a crucial role of the education system and the media to inform people about things they have never faced themselves. If there is no education system or media platform to perform this role, no meaningful large-scale conversations can take place. In a small Neolithic town of a few thousand inhabitants, people might sometimes have been afraid to say what they thought, or might have refused to listen to their rivals. But it was relatively easy to satisfy the more fundamental technical preconditions for meaningful discourse. First, people lived in proximity to one another, so they could easily meet most other community members and hear their voices. Second, everybody had intimate knowledge of the dangers and opportunities that the town faced. If an enemy war party approached, everyone could see it. If the river flooded the fields, everyone witnessed the economic effects. When people talked about war and hunger, they knew what they were saying. In the 4th century BCE, the city-state of Rome was still small enough to allow a large percentage of its citizens to congregate in the forum in times of emergency, listen to respected leaders, and voice their personal views on the matter at hand. When in 390 BCE Gallic invaders attacked Rome, almost everyone lost a relative in the defeat at the Battle of the Allia and lost property when the victorious Gauls then sacked Rome. The desperate Romans appointed Marcus Camillus as dictator. In Rome, the dictator was a public official appointed in times of emergency who had unlimited powers but only for a short predetermined period, following which he was held accountable for his actions. After Camillus led the Romans to victory, everybody could see that the emergency was over, and Camillus stepped down. In contrast, by the 3rd century CE, the Roman Empire had a population of between 60 and 75 million people, spread over 5 million square kilometers. Rome lacked mass communication technology like radio or daily newspapers. Only 10 to 20% of adults had reading skills, and there was no organized education system that could inform them about the geography, history, and economy of the empire. True, many people across the empire did share some cultural ideas, such as a strong belief in the superiority of Roman civilization over the barbarians. These shared cultural beliefs were crucial in preserving order and holding the empire together. But their political implications were far from clear, and in times of crisis, there was no possibility of holding a public conversation about what should be done. How could Syrian merchants, British shepherds, and Egyptian villagers converse about the ongoing wars in the Middle East or about the immigration crisis brewing along the Danube? The lack of a meaningful public conversation was not the fault of Augustus, Nero, Caracalla, or any of the other emperors. They didn't sabotage Roman democracy. Given the size of the empire and the available information technology, democracy was simply unworkable. This was acknowledged already by ancient philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, who argued that democracy can work only in small-scale city-states. If the absence of Roman democracy had merely been the fault of particular autocrats, we should have at least seen large-scale democracies flourishing in other places, like in Sasanian Persia, Gupta India, or Han China. But prior to the development of modern information technology, there are no examples of large-scale democracies anywhere. It should be stressed that in many large-scale autocracies, local affairs were often managed democratically. The Roman emperor didn't have the information needed to micromanage hundreds of cities across the empire, whereas local citizens in each city could continue to hold a meaningful conversation about municipal politics. Consequently, long after the Roman Empire became an autocracy, many of its cities continued to be governed by local assemblies and elected officials. At a time when elections to the consulship in Rome became ceremonial affairs, elections to municipal offices in small cities like Pompeii were hotly contested. Pompeii was destroyed in the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 CE during the reign of the Emperor Titus. Archaeologists uncovered about 1,500 graffiti concerned with various local election campaigns. One coveted office was that of the city's aedile, the magistrate in charge of maintaining the city's infrastructure and public buildings. Lucretius Fronto's supporters drew the graffiti, "If honest living is thought to be any recommendation, then Lucretius Fronto is worthy of being elected." One of his opponents, Gaius Julius Polybius, ran with the slogan, "Elect Gaius Julius Polybius to the office of aedile. He provides good bread." There were also endorsements by religious groups and professional associations, such as the Worshippers of Isis demand the election of Gnaeus Helvius Sabinus, and all the mule drivers request that you elect Gaius Julius Polybius. There was dirty work too. Someone who clearly wasn't Marcus Carinius Vatia drew the graffiti, "All the drunkards ask you to elect Marcus Carinius Vatia," and "The petty thieves ask you to elect Vatia." Such electioneering indicates that the position of aedile had power in Pompeii, and that the aedile was chosen in relatively free and fair elections, rather than appointed by the imperial autocrat in Rome. Even in empires whose rulers never had any democratic pretensions, democracy could still flourish in local settings. In the Tsarist Empire, for example, the daily lives of millions of villagers were managed by rural communes. Going back at least to the 11th century, each commune usually included fewer than 1,000 people. They were subject to a landlord and bore many obligations to their lord and to the central Tsarist state, but they had considerable autonomy in managing their internal affairs and in deciding how to discharge their external obligations, such as paying taxes and providing military recruits. The commune mediated local disputes, provided emergency relief, enforced social norms, oversaw the distribution of land to individual households, and regulated access to shared resources like forests and pastures. Decisions on important matters were made in communal meetings in which the heads of local households expressed their views and chose the commune's elder. Resolutions at least tried to reflect the majority's will. In Tsarist villages and Roman cities, a form of democracy was possible because a meaningful public conversation was possible. Pompeii was a city of about 11,000 people in 79 CE, so everybody could supposedly judge for themselves whether Lucretius Fronto was an honest man and whether Marcus Carinius Vatia was a drunken thief. But democracy at a scale of millions became possible only in the modern age, when mass media changed the nature of large-scale information networks. Mass media makes mass democracy possible. Mass media are information technologies that can quickly connect millions of people even when they are separated by vast distances. The printing press was a crucial step in that direction. Print made it possible to cheaply and quickly produce large numbers of books and pamphlets, which enabled more people to voice their opinions and be heard over a large territory, even if the process still took time. This sustained some of the first experiments in large-scale democracy, such as the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth established in 1569 and the Dutch Republic established in 1579. Some may contest the characterization of these polities as democratic, since only a minority of relatively wealthy citizens enjoyed full political rights. In the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, political rights were reserved for adult male members of the Szlachta, the nobility. These numbered up to 300,000 individuals, or about 5% of the total adult population. One of the Szlachta's prerogatives was to elect the king, But since voting required travelling long distances to a national convention, few exercised their right. In the 16th and 17th centuries, participation in royal elections usually ranged between 3,000 and 7,000 voters, except for the 1669 elections, in which 11,271 participated. While this hardly sounds democratic in the 21st century,